Good morning. You're listening to Neon Eden on 91.5 KUNV. I'm your host, Tobin LePan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. My co-host is Andrew Doman, political reporter for the Las Vegas Sun.
Good morning.
The last few weeks have been busy for Clark County's law enforcement and public safety officials. The fire in Mount Charleston was beaten back, but much work is left to be done in the Spring Mountains. On July 22nd, a search and rescue officer died while attempting to help a stranded hiker on Mount Charleston. And today we have Las Vegas crime and courts reporter Jackie Valley in the studio to talk about the events of Mount Charleston and the last few weeks and other news in the law enforcement community. Thanks for joining us, Jackie.
Thank you.
And well, let's start with the officer who died tragically trying to rescue the hiker. That was Officer David Van Buskirk. And he was honored on Monday. There was a funeral procession for him, and he was laid to rest. But what do we know about what happened that day on the mountain?
As far as everyone can tell, it was, you know, a pure freak tragedy. He had been lowered down from the helicopter. He was one of five people on board the helicopter, and his mission was to actually be the rescuer lowered down on this hoist cable. So he got lowered down to the rock cliff edge, attached the stranded hiker, and then somehow in the process of being pulled up, he was the one that fell loose or cable snapped and fell to the canyon below. What they don't know is exactly how far he fell or what caused him to fall. That's all still part of the investigation.
So they still don't know if it was an equipment failure or an actual like break in the line?
Correct. They were really hesitant to call it equipment malfunction at this point, but it seems like that's probably the most logical answer. They just hadn't, as of late last week, they hadn't made any determination.
Okay. So will there be an investigation into into everything?
Yeah, there's multiple entities investigating, including the occupational safe.
OSHA, right?
OSHA, yeah.
All right. And what you also, you asked his colleagues about him and did some work on, and just what he was like as a person. And what did you find out?
Yeah, I mean, by all counts, he was the officer you wanted to be around. He had worked his way up into the search and rescue unit, which is a pretty close-knit team. He, in fact, did a lot of the training for Drug Enforcement Administration agents when they were doing the marijuana grow operations in the mountains. He did a lot of their tactical training and emergency first aid. And apparently, he was just the most thorough employee and was really an advocate for safety, which is, I guess, the tragedy in all of this is that it was likely a equipment malfunction that ended up leading to his death. But yeah, they said he, if you were on the cable, you wanted him next to you. And he just had a very calm demeanor, always seemed relaxed, confident, and also, you know, just a good person. He apparently in his academy class was the one who would make jokes to kind of ease the tension at the end of the day, and just a good overall person.
And how many years had he been doing the search and rescue, do you know?
I believe since 2007.
Oh, so I mean, he was a pro, you know, he'd been doing it for
right.
a while, right?
And yeah.
He must have gone out on a lot of these.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed like someone who was certainly well-trained, had done this for a while, just kind of seemed to be an accident here. I mean, and the hiker, of course, is what's that, the status
the
of the hiker?
The hiker was fine.
Now?
The hiker made it back up. They haven't released a whole lot of information. We know it was a male hiker. He was apparently disoriented at the time that the initial call was made reporting him being stranded. But yeah, you know, his Officer Van Gusberg's last act really was saving a life in the process. Mm-hmm. So Metro did say that in the past year, the search and rescue unit has performed 150 rescues, saving a total of 173 people. And of those, 130 involved helicopters. So it's not like this was a super rare occurrence using the rescue to go in and save right. someone. It's pretty common.
Has there been any talk that possibly this event, this tragedy, will maybe lead, I don't know, they'll change, they'll look at their standards and their procedures for these, you know, how maybe checking the wires or how they go about doing these rescues?
Yeah, I think you can expect any time there's an accident like this, they'll do their due diligence and tweak whatever they can in the process. Mm-hmm. They just haven't gone into specifics since there hasn't been a final ruling yet.
So was the hiker up there alone? Was he, you said he was disoriented. Was he lost and with no friends or anyone up there?
It appears that he was in a restricted area where he shouldn't have been because of the wildfire, actually, and he was rescued alone. So as far as whether he deviated from a group, that's still unclear. But yeah, he was the only person rescued at the time.
And also, well, obviously you just mentioned it, there was the fire on Mount Charleston just before this, the hiker had needed to be rescued, but that was contained in the days leading up to that. And so what's happening now on the mountain? What needs to be done now that the firefighters have sort of packed up and gone?
Well, there still are some firefighters up there. It's a tier 3 team, so it's, you know, the local authorities now, because there is still a fire burning up there, but it's in the highest peaks, so that's not expected to be completely out until a weather phenomenon such as heavy rainfall and or snow.
Winter comes.
Yeah, which could be winter. So, that's what authorities kept telling people, don't necessarily be nervous to come up to Mount Charleston. You're going to see smoke in the distance. It's fine. It's under control. And it's mostly a waiting game right now. As far as aftermath, however, there has been the BEAR team, which is the Burned Area Response Team, or Burned Area Emergency Response Team, that's been up there. And that's a collection of soil scientists, hydrologists, engineers, and ecologists, I believe. Mm-hmm. So it's about a dozen to 15 people who go into the wildfire area afterward and examine everything from infrastructure to soil makeup and water flow. So they were in there for about a week and should have wrapped up either Friday or early this week. And their next step was to send a report to the Forest Service administrators. So the BEAR team should be wrapping up their final report and sending it to the Forest Service administrators locally sometime early this week. And what that means is basically they have their initial assessment done. So they surveyed multiple locations across the wildfire region and are showing their analysis and then possible treatment recommendations. Now, they've been very hesitant to say what those treatment recommendations are, but they said as far as wildfires, it was typical. There wasn't anything terribly extreme about this one, or, it also wasn't terribly low level either. It was right about average.
Mm-hmm. So isn't I find it kind of ironic. There was a big fire up there, and now it seems like the greatest danger seems to be water now, that a lot of the vegetation has been burnt off. And if it rains, there could be mudslides, right? Is that the next threat for people, anyone living up there?
It is. I wouldn't necessarily call it a huge threat, because they have analyzed it, and I don't think they would let people move back in if they felt it was a huge risk. But we were up there late last week with members of the BEAR team, and in areas where the fire burned, there's a couple-inch thick layer of ash. So they did a water test and basically dug into the soil and examined how the droplets absorbed, and it didn't absorb as fastly as what normally would occur before the fire. So their concern is stream flow. If there's a heavy rainfall, that, like Andrew said, if there's not enough vegetation to soak it up, it could run downstream fast.
And what about wildlife? Well, what are sort of the species that they're most concerned about that maybe, live in Mount Charleston, or that they're most concerned for?
Other than the one butterfly species that's...
The blue butterfly?
Yeah. They haven't specified any that are really at risk. I think a lot of them didn't move downhill or got out of the way quick enough. So they haven't touched on that a whole lot.
All the animals, they ran away like Bambi, right? Fleeing the fire.
Yeah, and we were up there and we saw deer in the area, and that other people reported seeing coyotes. And
what is, have they mentioned sort of, when, what are we looking at in terms of time spans for Mount Charleston to look like it looked before, or just to, be green again in certain areas?
The BEAR team's prediction for one area above north of the Cathedral Rock picnic area was that it will be green by next year. We were up there, and they said that in that area, it was a lot of smaller brush and trees, and those should sprout back to life, that the roots weren't necessarily endangered. It's, charred extremities, basically. Mm-hmm. However, some of the harder hit areas where the fire intensity was greater, Harris Springs, for example, that will be years probably.
So what's it look like up there? I didn't have a chance to go up there, and down here in the valley, we saw some really stunning sunsets, basically, and a lot of smoke. But is it just charred, black, barren hilltops, or what is it? What's it look like?
No, I think people would be surprised as you're driving in. it looks normal until you get to the Harris Springs area. And that's where the wildfire crossed State Route 157 at one point. And right there, everything's charred. And it's exactly like you described, little skeletal trees, black spots on the ground. But, you know, that was for maybe a couple hundred feet. And you drive along, and it's fine. You get up to Mount Charleston, and you can see the Cathedral Rock area above that, or I guess a little bit below. There's a patch of burned area. But it's not as devastating as you would think. It's a little bit more cleared out, maybe not as dense. You can see where the ash is in that part. I think the harder hit areas are probably harder for most people to see unless you're on a particularly strenuous trail. And that's what a lot of the lodge owners, the owner of the lodge and the resort, they were really grateful that it wasn't worse, because they said a lot of their customer base comes up specifically for the scenic views. So in their settings, the scenic views really weren't harmed all that much.
What about the ski resort? Do they suffer any, like, damage? I mean, will it affect the winter season for them at all? And
I haven't heard any talk of that. That's up closer to Lee Canyon, and Lee Canyon wasn't really affected. So that should be status quo, I assume.
And then there was, in terms of the loss of property, there was one ranch, right, that burned?
Yeah, the Prospect Ranch, which is out toward Harris Spring, that was a loss. And I don't know an exact dollar figure at the moment, but everything else was spared.
And now, also, you know, anybody who's from out of town like me knows that it's a little crazy driving in Las Vegas, and you recently took a look at the most dangerous intersections and I guess the most accident prone. Is that for vehicles and pedestrians?
Well, any accident that involves a vehicle. So some of them do involve pedestrians. In fact, I think 50% of that accidents that involve fatalities so far this year did involve pedestrians.
And we have high rates here in the valley, right, of pedestrians being hit by vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, you could say the general rule in Vegas is don't walk anywhere.
Right. Sadly. So what did you find? Where are the places where people maybe need to be most vigilant and cautious?
You know, I've done the same thing every year. I usually take a look at the dangerous intersections about every 6 months, and they're relatively the same. They just change order a little bit. But this year, they are Lamb Boulevard and Charleston Boulevard, the intersection of Sahara Avenue and Decatur Boulevard, intersection of Charleston Boulevard and Rainbow Boulevard, Flamingo Road and Maryland Parkway, Cobalt Lane and Tropicana Avenue, Las Vegas Boulevard and Flamingo Road, Flamingo Road and Eastern Avenue, Flamingo Road and Rainbow Boulevard, Nellis Boulevard and Stewart Avenue, and Vegas Valley Drive and Nellis Boulevard. So if you're listening closely, there were four intersections involving Flamingo Road.
Is there anything about Flamingo that's inherently, more dangerous?
I don't know if you can single Flamingo Road out, because if you look at all of these roads, you know, Lamb, Charleston, Decatur, Flamingo, they're all multi-lane roads with lots of retail on either side, double turn lanes. I think Flamingo Road is one of the most traveled going in and out of the strip, and that's maybe why you tend to see more. But, you know, there was one intersection that was on the west side involving Flamingo Road, one near UNLV, and then a couple on the east. So I don't necessarily know you can pin that down as the worst, but it's certainly one to pay a little bit more attention to as you're driving.
So you've got just a ton of cars coming in and out, a lot of commercial retail there, a lot of lanes of traffic. Is this just sort of what we'd expect, or is there anything we can do to increase safety for? But you mentioned half the people who are killed in these traffic accidents are people who are on the sidewalks, maybe crossing the street, pedestrians, right?
Right, and the general standard with pedestrian accidents is a lot of them are pedestrians at fault, people who aren't using the crosswalks, crossing in the middle of the street, crossing in the dark late at night. So I think that's one thing that the police would probably really want to drive home, is the fact that if you're going to cross a road, go to the crosswalk, wait for the signal, and then even then double check and make sure there's not a car that is perhaps not paying attention.
Right. And is the RTC trying to, I don't know, maybe install certain things at these, or do anything differently at these intersections, or the ones that are historically problematic?
Not that I know of. I know they take a look at all the intersections on a regular basis to see, but some of it is just volume of traffic, and I don't know if there's really anything that can be done.
Right.
And, you know, these are accidents with injuries. It's not necessarily where all the fatal accidents happen either. So that's something to also keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. All right. And moving on. So last week, Sheriff Doug Gillespie, he made a decision regarding a Metro officer who shot a man in the leg accidentally. What happened exactly in this case?
This was one of those weird officer-involved shooting cases. It was back on November 11th, 2012. Officer Roston was responding to a domestic violence call in the Eastern Valley. Typically, domestic violence calls are known as the most dangerous because they have very volatile. You never really know what you're walking into. In this case, the woman had called to report that her ex-boyfriend had beaten her and damaged her vehicle. So Officer Roston arrives, you know, got the woman out of the vehicle. The ex-boyfriend remained inside. Long story short, he approaches the vehicle to speak to the ex-boyfriend. The boyfriend seems to duck under the or reach under the seat and grab something. Roston mistakes it for a gun, shoots the guy. It actually was a hat with a shiny metallic emblem on it that he didn't realize was such. The new officer, when Sheriff Gillespie talked about this case last week, he did mention that the ex-boyfriend was also trying to hide marijuana under the seat, and that's something that hadn't been brought to the limelight before.
But he had no weapon.
He had no weapon. He was unarmed completely.
Okay. Well, I don't know if he was going to throw the bags of marijuana at him or something, and that was a threat. But
the guy was shot in the leg. He did survive.
He did survive. Okay. And so first this goes, there's this whole new board, right? The use of force board, which is a little different than how they used to review these cases before.
Right.
And so what did the use of force board say?
So they took a look at this case a few months ago, and their determination was that he should be fired, essentially, from the department. Their rationale was that he didn't seem to show any remorse or admit his mistakes. Mm-hmm. Then it goes to the another board, and Sheriff Gillespie ultimately has the final say, and the pre-termination hearing board at that point determined that he maybe should be disciplined rather harshly, but not ultimately fired. Gillespie, in his news conference last week, said Roston made a huge mistake in not admitting that initial mistake, and that after the use of force board, he basically admitted to his faults, and the sheriff had a private conversation with him where he did so again, and so the sheriff agreed with the pre-termination board hearing and disciplined rather than fired.
So what happened to the guy who got shot? Does he think that the officer should be let go, or is what happened to him?
You know, he was injured. I don't know his exact thoughts on this case, but I know he
was. Was he ever charged with a crime?
Not that I recall.
Okay, and so it goes to the pre-termination board, and they recommend something to Gillespie, or is Gillespie part of that board?
Yeah, they will do their own recommendation at that point, and then Gillespie will take a look at it, and he has the final say either way.
Nice. So use of force board said he should be fired permanently. And what did Gillespie ultimately decide?
No termination, but that he would be suspended without pay for 40 hours.
So one week without pay.
Which is apparently Metro's maximum discipline.
I see. Okay.
So I'm curious if the guy didn't get arrested in the end, you know, maybe he, you know, allegedly beat up his girlfriend here. You know, certainly not something he'd want to do. But he basically got shot when he shouldn't have been shot. So what happens if you get accidentally shot by the police in the leg? I mean, you're okay, but you still got shot in the leg. Presumably went to the hospital. Who ends up paying for something like that? If I accidentally get shot, would I be on the hook?
Well, for his medical bills? Yeah, I don't know. Is there some fund? Do they pay out, or does he have to sue them civilly, maybe?
I imagine there will be a civil lawsuit at some point, if not already in the works. There is a program called Victims of Crime, and I'm not sure if this would qualify the case. It might be a little bit murky.
Right.
But sometimes the fund will help pay medical bills.
Right. I'd like to get back, though, to this use of force board, right? This is a new board, right? There, that is what started last year as part of a reform?
Yeah, it was tweaked, so it has some civilian membership on it as well.
And so they make the initial sort of recommendation, but that's a non-binding recommendation.
It's non-binding. The officer in question has to appear before the board, then I think is interviewed essentially in front of the board.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, Gillespie insinuated that Officer Rawson didn't totally understand how it worked and was more fearful of the board in a sense, and that's why he didn't own up to his mistakes initially. The one question I asked during the press conference was, you know, did he admit fault later on just as a way to save his job, or was he actually sincere about it?
Uh-huh.
And Gillespie, of course, said that he thought he was sincere, but with the caveat that after he does his suspension and he goes through training, if they don't think he's taking it seriously enough, Gillespie will still move to terminate his position.
So what kind of training is this? I mean, as a police officer, you know, how are you trained, you know, when to pull out your gun or when it should stay in its holster?
Well, and that'll basically be the gist of his training, will be about, you know, use of force. And in particular, they said they would focus on his perception of danger because that's what was askew in this case.
Mm-hmm. And so if the use of force board can recommend firing someone and that they lose their job, and then the sheriff can come back and say, no, we'll just give them 1 week off without pay, why have the use of force? I mean, are they concerned at all about that their recommendations will just be this silent, you know, this voice in the wind that nobody pays attention to in the future?
I think there is that criticism, and I think it's probably legitimate, is that it's non-binding, and it's more about, it's a recommendation. It's mm-hmm. not anything more than that.
Did they comment? Did anybody from the use of force board comment publicly after Gillespie's decision?
No.
No. Okay. Well,
I guess transition here over to another topic that Metro deals with, I guess, on a unfortunately on a regular basis. But yesterday there was a nationwide sting. The FBI arrested here just in Las Vegas 41 adult prostitutes, rescued one juvenile who's in prostitution, and also arrested one person for pandering, for soliciting. Jackie, I know you've done some reporting on this issue. How big is the problem here in Las Vegas when it comes to sex trafficking?
Well, they call Vegas ground zero in the United States for sex trafficking, and I think with good reason. It tends to be a place where people are just come on their own, end up here, and fall into it, or are recruited here with, you know, dreams of it turning out to be something better than it actually is, and then they fall in with a pimp.
So what's Metro doing? Are they partnering with other organizations? I read recently that one thing that at least they're looking at in Reno is setting up a kind of a girls' home, a shelter for some of the, especially the juveniles who are in prostitution and then are.
That's long been the goal in Vegas. Mm-hmm. It's a tough battle. It's been championed by Judge Voy of Family Court, is to create essentially a safe house for the juvenile victims. The one problem they run into is they'll essentially have to arrest the girls for soliciting prostitution. But it's a catch-22 because it's not really helping the girls by arresting them. So they'll arrest them. A lot of times there's, you know, deep emotional trouble with these girls, and they feel attached to their pimps, and they think they love them, and so on and so forth. So the girls don't necessarily stay. They'll flee as soon as they get released from the juvenile detention center. So Judge Voy's vision, along with several others, was to build a safe house where the girls are essentially monitored and place for them to stay, rehabilitate, and then get out of that lifestyle.
And it's not be as restrictive as a juvenile
detention. Right, so that it's a home as opposed to a jail cell, and it's more nurturing.
But no one wants to pay for this? There's no one in the community who thinks this is a worthwhile thing to donate some money for? Is that the problem here?
Yeah, I think you can say funding is probably the main problem. There just hasn't been enough of a collective effort to get it up and going. There's been a lot of ideas better around and, you know, some grant funding, but never enough to get the home up and going. I think you'll see more pressure in the coming year or so. They've really ramped up efforts to make this a point of conversation in Las Vegas. They have a new director for the Southern Nevada Human Trafficking Task Force, and she was hired in to basically corral community members to address this issue. As for whether the safe house will get the funding, that's anyone's guess.
And now few, I think like a month or so ago, there was a story, they staked out, I guess it was a home in North Las Vegas that was being used as a brothel, right? And can you tell us a little bit about that, what was going on in that neighborhood?
Yeah, they had received a tip about it and did their due diligence, staked it out, saw lots of mail coming and going, odd hours, lots of traffic, but it didn't appear people actually lived there. So they executed search warrants and in the process found a male, I believe three females, and then another male who they believe was a customer at the time inside. From what it sounded like initially, it was there was a male running the brothel and possibly a woman working with him, but then the two or three other females in the house were being used as prostitutes.
And so do they think this is, in terms of other houses, do they think there's other houses like this that just, that are set up, sort of like just single family homes, but
yeah,
they're brothels?
What police will tell you is that they're all over the valley. This one happened to be in North Las Vegas. I don't think it was a terribly well-to-do area, but you know, the brothel could be around the corner in your neighborhood. And I think what police would like the community to know is, you know, pay attention to your surroundings and your neighbors. Vegas isn't necessarily known as the friendliest community with lots of neighborhood participation. Mm-hmm. But if people watch comings and goings a little bit more, they might notice something that just seems off.
Well, no, of course, we're also ground zero for the housing crisis, lots of foreclosures, lots of vacancies. Are these just opportunists who come in? There's a place that's really cheap and they use it as a brothel? How does the housing crisis play out?
I think that could be a part of it because it's certainly making it easier in some regards to get ample space in terms of a house to use this for. But it's also just the nature of the town. I mean, there's enough customer base to, in the eyes of the owners, to run these brothels.
Now, this particular house was in a Hispanic community and there were Hispanics who were arrested and involved with it. But sex trafficking, we should say, right, can be anybody. It doesn't necessarily have to be across borders. It can just be any kind of recruiting people into
it's across the board.
But do police find it more difficult, say, to investigate cases involving, I don't know, the large Asian community that we have in the county or the Hispanic community because of language? I mean, is it harder to investigate those cases?
I think it definitely can be. One thing I've heard vice detectives talk about is the fact that a lot of these brothels are ethnic-based. So it could just, you know, Hispanic, Filipino, other Asian ethnicities. And then that's what's driving the customer base. So it's very specific a lot of times.
So I guess you're like undercover. They have a vice squad, right? Undercover detectives that work on these things. So I guess you have to have a lot of different people ready. You maybe speak Spanish. You have to speak maybe Tagalog fluently, those types of things.
Yeah. And a lot of, in these cases with the brothels, some of the women are, you know, brought here from other countries and under the guise that they'll work in these brothels and that's the way they'll like pay back whoever brought them. So it can be a dicey situation in that respect too, because the girls don't necessarily know that they're being taken advantage of in the truest sense.
Jackie, thanks for joining us. That was Jackie Valley, our public safety reporter here at the Las Vegas Sun. That's all we have time for today. My co-host is Andrew Doman. You've been listening to Neon Eden on 91.5 KUNV. Our producer is Steven Zeller, and see you next week. Thank you.